Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by The Isley Brothers, The Carpenters, The Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hey, this is Trevor from Halifax calling in to say that I support Creative Control on Patreon because I think long-form arts journalism is a crucial part of music culture and there's simply not enough of it out there today. Vish is a master interviewer, he lands great guests, and he has his finger on the pulse of the ever-changing music landscape both here in Canada and abroad. For all of these reasons and many more, I think you should support Creative Control on Patreon too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Visha's wife, and I will love him no matter what you do. And now he has me on the record saying that.
You counted backwards, so I don't. All I
Eric Chenow is a songwriter, guitarist, singer, film score composer, and sound sculptor currently based in South Central France. Initially well regarded for his role in the excellent and explosive post-punk bands Flag Camp and Life Like Weeds, Chenow went on to be a driving force in Toronto's exhilarating and subversive improvised music community, co-founding the impressively eclectic label Rat Drifting, and engaging in many collaborations, and prolifically participating in recorded works. Since 2006, Constellation Records has released some of Chenow's most astonishing solo albums, including his latest record, Say Laura, which is available on February 18th, 2022. Eric and I connected recently so that he could return to this show to discuss his move from Toronto to France and why he bought his primary guitar in Edmonton, Alberta, the artistic temperament of his dear friend Ryan Driver, the making of Say Laura, and how it was heavily influenced by hip-hop beats found on records by the likes of Gangstar and EPMD, why we don't hear such beats on Say Laura at all, really, but at the same time we do, the relationship between comedy, surrealism, and improvisation, Harry Dean Stanton, nihilism, Gavin Bryars, and jazz, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is the 662nd episode of Creative Control featuring the lovely and talented Eric Chenault with your host, me, Vish Khanna.
So
hi, Eric. How's it going?
Good, Vish. Thank you. I'm doing fine. Thanks.
It's nice to speak with you. First of all, I think I know the answer to this, but where in the world are you today?
Today, I am in my studio, which is in a house that is called the Pouget, which is in a town called Condat-sur-Ganave, which is in the region of Corrèze, in what I like to call South Central France. Though the French do not use this term, but geographically, it is South Central France.
So. Why are you in opposition to French custom? Why have you given your region a name that they themselves would not give it? Why is this?
It's an ode to hip hop. to be from South Central France just seems, you know, seems wonderful.
Particularly yeah. West Coast hip-hop. South Central L.A. is the illusion?
Exactly.
Is
that South Central California, yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Now, you've been on this... first of all, I mean, as you know, Eric, we've talked for a long time, many years. Mostly you've been in Toronto for those talks, but I think the last time... Yeah, the last time you were on this particular iteration of my expression in the media world, it was this podcast, and you were in France. So how long have you been in France again?
11 years. The last time we spoke, I was in Saint-Ouen, which is a suburb of Paris, where I lived for 10 years.
I see. So this is a recent relocation. Why did you relocate?
Because it's really beautiful, Vish.
Ah.
It's really beautiful down here.
Oh, nice. Well, that's great. And I'm happy you're thriving. Given the calamity of the world, do you feel like you're in a particularly safe spot? Have you ever thought about coming back to Canada at any point and settling in, or are you feeling like you're ensconced now?
Yeah, I'm home. In fact, I was just back in Toronto about a month ago, and apart from friends whom I have, for better, you know, I have attempted to maintain a relationship, I don't feel much of a connection to the city in the way that I did when I first moved from Toronto. So, no, I haven't thought of that. I love very much where we live here. I'm quite happy. We live in the countryside, quite the countryside in the forest, really. And so considering the state of things... we've been very lucky where we live. There, confinement doesn't really say very much. I mean, you know, we have acres and acres of land. I can go walking. I can be outside. We have a rather large, spacious house. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we're very lucky considering.
Well, that's great. That's excellent. And I don't know if you know this, but my family and I relocated as well. At the end, very late 2019, but ostensibly early January 2020, we are now in Edmonton, Alberta. So
where my guitar is from.
Oh, your guitar? Which guitar is from Edmonton?
My only real guitar, my electric guitar.
Oh.
My Gibson 175 is from Edmonton.
Was it a used purchase that you made and ordered on the internet, or were you in town?
I was there.
Oh.
I was actually there playing with King Cobb Steely, in fact.
Oh.
And I walked into Avenue Guitars, which is owned by a friend, owned by a friend of a friend of Martin Arnold's. And that guitar was hanging there, and yeah, I got it.
Nice. That's great. Were you?
It's been my only guitar for since then, which is about 20-something years now.
So you have a soft spot for Edmonton, even as I am like conflicted about our move to Alberta during because of the pandemic calamity. But you have a soft spot for Alberta and Edmonton because of the guitar?
You've got it, Vish. A big soft spot. Yeah.
What about me? What about me being here? Does that make it a softer spot, or is this irrelevant?
It makes it a lush spot. A very lush, lush spot.
That's nice. It's always kind to hear from you and feel the warmth from you, Eric. I appreciate it. It really does mean a lot. Were you in... I can't recall. Were you playing in King Cobb Steely at the time?
I was, yeah.
Oh, okay, nice.
Yeah.
It's hard to keep track of everyone. I love that band, but it's hard to keep track of all the people who were in it at various points.
Indeed, yeah. I think I played in it for about a year.
A year? Okay.
Yeah, but maybe more. I mean, I don't have a very good memory.
Here's a random question, because I saw the band quite a bit, but not also... I shouldn't say quite a bit. I saw them back in that era. What era is this, by the way? Sorry, I don't even know. What year, roughly? What year was it that you were in that band?
Oh, my. Now you're hitting my... Yeah, I would just need a moment. I'll think about it while I'm
rambling. Sure, because I once saw them. It wasn't the first time, I don't think, but I once saw King Cobb Steely play a side stage for a giant Beastie Boys concert. Did you happen to play that show?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay,
sadly,
yes, it was great. They performed, I believe, just before R.L. Burnside and.
Wow.
The Deadly Snakes played that same side stage. That was the only first time, rather, I saw them. And then, yeah, Beastie Boys and A Tribe Called Quest were supposed to play.
Oh.
But Tribe had to cancel, and instead Biz Markie performed. And so it was giant field.
That's.
So it was...
That sounds wonderful. No, I missed that one.
Anyway, sorry. We're all... This hip-hop thing, I think, will come up during our conversation because I'm very curious about... this new record and its relation to hip-hop based on the biographical information I've been sent. But now that you're here with me, horse's mouth, I want to hear exactly what has gone on. So first of all, congratulations on this beautiful new album, Say Laura. This is your first record in, I want to say, has it been 4 years? Is that the last time you were on the show? I feel like it was. Is that correct?
It could be 4 years, yeah.
I know time... When you're in France, do you even notice the time? Time's just moving along. You don't know what year it is. Is that fair?
Yeah, you notice it. You notice time.
Okay.
You'd have to be pretty nuts.
Yeah, sure.
To not, at the very least, notice
yes.
it.
Yes, okay. So this record, I'm going to get to the hip-hop in a moment, but this record is primarily you, but it also features a collaboration with your longtime friend and collaborator, Ryan Driver, which, to my knowledge, he's on Wurlitzer. First of all, is that correct?
That is correct.
And how did the recording collaboration work exactly, you being in France? Ryan, as far as I know, still being in Toronto, did you come here or did he go there? What happened?
Neither. We did it by Zoom.
By Zoom? You played together on Zoom?
No. He overdubbed.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
I see.
He was in the studio of my friend and yours, Sandro Perry.
Ah.
And they did it. I mean, I didn't really need to be there, but, you know, it was nice. I mean, because, in fact, the notes that I did give him after his first take, he failed to follow, and all for the better. But there is a radical reticence on Ryan's part sometimes that is part and parcel of the charm of his genius. But yeah, we did it by Zoom. Yep. And he did two takes of both songs, the first and the last,
right.
And maybe three of one. And that was it. And we wrapped up the session.
Okay. All right. So, and does Ryan normally, you seem to be resigned to the fact that Ryan isn't always going to listen to any kind of instruction. Has he ever said, yes, Eric, that is correct. I will do that. Or does he always
do that? He says that. Okay. And then he does not necessarily do that. I'm talking about one very specific thing where I told him to solo and he said, well, you can't possibly mean like a real solo. And I said, yes, a real solo. And then he did not. He played something that I suppose ended up being a solo, but I did some very micro editing to kind of form a solo. That was a lot of fun.
Now, does Ryan, I know Ryan, I should talk to Ryan at some point one-on-one for this particular thing I make, but and I haven't done it yet, but does Ryan do things like that for any kind of comedic effect, or does he just do it because he's Ryan? Because I get the sense from him that he's a peculiar breed of cat in his own way, but I love him, but he is a little odd sometimes. Do you think he's doing it to be funny, or does he like the tension of the... Is there humor in that tension of I didn't listen to you, or is it just because he thinks he's right and everyone else is wrong?
No, absolutely not the later. At least not with me. He's a very open, beautiful musician who, and anyone who has heard anything he's done would know that. To be honest, with what can I say? It's not in any way to be rebarbative. It's not necessarily to be difficult unless he thinks that. What can I say? I would say that being a wonderful improviser, as he is,
yeah.
I don't think he enjoys the pressure of expectation. I think that he would think that that perhaps the world would be better without it.
Is the pressure of expectation a longhand way of saying structure?
No, not necessarily structure, but I've always thought it. And you know, the first time we played together was at the Cameron, I believe, Doug Tielli. This was 1990 something, late 1990s, and it was a very, very touching duo. And all of the things that I thought that night, I still think, and. I would say that Ryan is musically. We're not talking about necessarily about him as a person or in private or what have you.
Yeah.
I really think that he is a surrealist in a radical sense, and the surrealist relationship with reality is one of lightness.
Yes.
When it's great, and I think that. I consider that the reticence of expectation a way of maintaining lightness.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that no matter what, that lightness is potentially more important than following one suggestion or another.
Yeah.
Keeping that the fidelity to lightness and joyfulness of that lightness is, I think, a huge part of his practice and one that I feel an incredible fidelity and love for.
Yeah. I want to touch upon this lightness and surreal aspect of Ryan's work in terms of your own practice, because I think I appreciate what you're saying about it. Humor, I think, is a really... I was trying to say, like, does Ryan think it's funny sometimes to resist structure or parameters or direction, what have you, but... Humor to me is a huge part of improvisation, but I feel like a lot of people take it so seriously as observers or as practitioners, or at least they come across as being very stoic and serious. Would you agree that humor, like in life, like improvisation is life, right? Everything we do every day is improvised. But do you feel like humor in your practice or in music with people like you or Ryan, is humor a big factor in your work?
I mean, we're human beings, so humor is going to be a part of at least one part of something. It's a difficult one.
May I interject for a moment and suggest to people that so Eric, the first song on your record, Say Laura, is called Hello, How, and Hey, and that is the way it's sort of structured. Hello, comma. How? Yeah. Question mark. And hey. Now, I will say two things about this. First of all, that's inherently eye-catching and funny. There's just something funny about that. And then the other thing I wanted to say is I first encountered this turn of phrase, if you will, I think from you, from an email in like 2019. It was like an email saying there was some sort of event going on. Dance piece, and then I believe it might have, was the dance piece called Hello, How, and Hey, or something along those lines? Is
for
that right?
For a short amount of time, it was. It was a working title that got changed right before the actual production of it, yeah.
Right, and this was a dance, so you provided, what, a live score for a dance piece? Is that what it occurred?
More or less, and that song was a part of it, yeah.
Okay, so thank you for establishing that. So I just wanted, I saw that on the record. I'm like, wait a minute, that sounds really familiar. And I didn't, this was in France, you did the dance piece, right? You didn't do that
it,
here
it was,
in Canada.
Yeah,
yeah so
it was, yeah.
I have no, obviously, I just remembered, my mind is interesting to me that I was like, wait a minute, Eric has used this before somewhere, I'm damn sure of it. And I remembered your email. That's, you say you have a lush soft spot for me, Eric. I just want to convey to you, similarly lush and soft spot for you in my mind. It's in there somewhere. My brain is soft for you. Anyway, my point is this. That expression, to me, has a little bit of eye-catching humor in it. Would you agree or disagree with that sentiment?
Absolutely. Again, in some way, I would... humor, I suppose, being a synonym for lightness, I suppose. It's a very light... something I'm attracted to aesthetically all the time, something that is buoyant, something that one does not need to read into so much, that on the surface itself, something is happening. Now, that line, that title, and the line that it comes from in the song was, again, written by Ryan Driver.
There you go. See, there's something. I think he's funny, and I think, but you appreciate.
He is funny.
You're also funny. I mean, I've seen you perform, and I've seen, like, but you, there is this sense that you're not trying to be funny. Do you know what I'm coming from here? I'm just trying to demystify some of the work, because I think some people, as you may know, in my time, definitely at the Guelph Jazz Festival and attending other improvised music festivals, you sit there and I think people are stifling the joy and the humor for the sake of some, I don't know, it's like intellectual pretense or something. I don't want to castigate a whole group of people, but sometimes I'm like, this is funny. It is funny that someone has decided to take apart a clarinet on stage. You know, like, that's kind of funny. Do you know what I'm saying?
Indeed. But, I mean, we can go, I could use two examples to agree with you and find a way out of that conundrum, which is, look at Buster Keaton.
Yes.
He does not smile.
That's true.
And he's hilarious.
That's
true. And he looks serious, and he looks melancholic, and it's just hilarious. So, when you're performing, you're performing. The other thing, more not necessarily... when you're making love to someone, Vish, you don't necessarily smile. That might even be considered creepy. And yet you're having a pretty good time. So I think there are a lot of ways to have a good time that aren't necessarily about showing that it's funny. It can be funny, and I agree. There, one can make the argument that there is a lack of eros in improvised music, or in contemporary music in general, for sure. But in terms of looking into the face of the performer for acknowledgement that something is funny, might not be entirely useful. I mean, who knows what the person is thinking while they're playing? The things that pop through my head as I'm playing are vast and wide.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm not even really listening to what I'm doing as part of the practice of improvising. So there's a lot of ways to have humor in the world. But again, I know where you're coming from, and I empathize with what you're talking about.
Well, I appreciate what you're saying as well. I think I've come to, as someone who's sort of a student of comedy as well, the more you learn about comedians, and I'm generalizing, of course, some are perfectly fine and happy. A lot of them tend to, be drawn to darkness and dark thoughts. And even Mel Brooks, or Buster Keaton, or whomever, they tend to delve into absurdism and the extremes of surrealism, because I think there's a patent feel, there's a patent sort of inherent feeling that life is strange, but not pointless. I don't want to sound dour, but just like life is random. And so the way you stave off the despair, existential angst and whatnot, is you embrace humor. And humor is meant to be a balm mm-hmm. against how dark life can be and how hard life can be. So you laugh at it. You make fun of it. You engage in sort of surreal, absurd behavior. And I feel like mm-hmm. on an intellectual level, the improvisers I've seen, the people who've engaged in strange sounds, as you do, you know, for years now, you seem to be... What are you doing there with your feet when you play your guitar, Eric? You're creating different rubbery sort of wah-wah-esque tones. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, one foot is on a wah-wah most of the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Overuse things. I have a very limited palette for... For me, the electronics are instruments. They aren't effects for the guitar. They yes. create new guitars.
Yes, exactly. So... Yeah. But I think it's also bending reality a little bit. I mean, when you use a distortion, it's called a distortion pedal. I mean, not a wah-wah pedal, but all of these things are meant to alter reality. So the mm-hmm. guitar, when you plug it in, sounds a certain way. Then you get mm-hmm. a bunch of things like you have, and it mm-hmm. alters reality. And I think it makes it, if you will, this is maybe a stretch, and shoot me down if you like, but it turns the guitar from a real thing to a surreal thing. Like, oh my God. That guy's foot is turning that guitar, which if it didn't have that stuff by his feet, would just sound like the way I think a guitar probably would sound, you know? Mm-hmm. But you're of the ilk, and a lot of people like you who are like, I'm going to either distort or radically alter the signal so that when it hits people, it's gonna sound bent or broken or different than what they're expecting. So I don't know where this came from, Eric. I'm just spitballing here, but there's something there. I feel like in your employment of surreal tones, humor, improvisation, and your practice. So I think you're funny. Mm-hmm. I'm not listening to Say Laura and being like, ha ha ha! Oh my God, he got me with that one. But, you know, yeah. I do have it on, and I'm like, wow, I play records in the house when I'm doing the dishes and cooking, so the kids hear it too, and they're like, what, you know, your record is one of those records where they're like, what the hell is going on, Papa? And I have to be like, oh, you know, and then your beautiful singing voice too gives it normalcy. Anyway, all this to say, so is anything that I'm saying resonating with you about your own practice?
Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't say things much differently at all.
Okay.
What can I mean...
Did I just encapsulate... I encapsulated you?
Sure. I mean, the thing is that for me, the things that we feel... For me, there's humor and melancholy. There's melancholy and humor, which is something you've already touched on mm-hmm. with comedians. There is... I think a lot of the things we feel, there are not clean lines between them. And I feel like my musical practice... more or less is interested in where things get a little sticky, where things get a little muddy, where things aren't necessarily clear, which is also something that you've kind of touched on. Although I think that there is a clarity there. It's just, it's a clarity that comes from a different place, if you know what I mean.
Well, there's a quote from you, I believe, in the biographical information.
Uh-oh.
Well, it's a quote from you, I think, either quoting or paraphrasing actor Harry Dean Stanton. And the line I'm referring to is, I care about everything, but who cares? And I think that's where I'm coming from, too, with comedians and people or improvisers. They care a lot about what they're doing, and they put a lot of thought into it. But there's also this sense of, who cares? It's sort of ephemeral, or it's fleeting, just like life. You know, like I'm going to try a joke, or I'm going to play the guitar a certain way. I care about everything, but who cares? Like, why did that? That was my take on it, and as it follows our just my line of reasoning here. But what does that quote mean to you?
Well, it's within the context of the interview with Harry Dean Stanton. Harry Dean Stanton is being pushed to talk about what the interviewer is calling nihilism, and Harry Dean Stanton questions him. He's like, "Well, what is nihilism?" Mm-hmm. And then so the interviewer responds, and Harry Dean Stanton's getting a little bit frustrated, and he's like, listen, I care about everything. Who cares? That contrapuntal beauty is a way of saying I'm engaged, but in a way that retains lightness, which, you know, it will be something perhaps we're going to get back to, is that the who cares is not nihilistic. And I think, I mean, with Harry Dean Stanton, it most certainly comes from a lot of Buddhist texts that he reads.
Yeah, yeah.
And the way he said it, though, I use that in my notes for the record because I was struck by it and watched it many times. But if you can find it on those internets, there's an interview with him that is just incredibly, for anyone who already loves his body of work and the way he is in films and outside of films, I would find this interview incredibly beautiful. Hmm. He's incredibly open. And but who cares is, again, lightness. It's joy. It's joyfulness.
Well, I didn't pick up on the, I guess it's sort of inherently, I could see how someone might read into that and think it was nihilistic, but to me, it suggests a letting go of something. Because that's, I feel like each, what's the expression we say to, like, oh, you just had a bad day. Tomorrow's a new day. And I feel like that is also probably vaguely in the vein of Buddhism, where you're just like, the thing that happened, and you move on kind of thing, and you try other things. So I care about everything, but who cares kind of feels like, it feels to me anyway along those lines. Like,
I think that it's actually the humor and the tone itself that is the message in that.
Yeah, sure.
The who cares isn't the answer, and the I care about everything isn't the answer.
Right.
But it opens up a form of imagining what is in between I care about everything and who cares.
Right.
And that space is open.
Right.
And that's what I'm calling lightness.
I see.
He's being very clear, but he is allowing a space to open up between two things that might seem that they are at odds with each other.
Right.
And to break down some kind of, you know, binary method of being in the world, which I think, whew, right now we could all use a little bit of that.
Yeah. 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 Absolutely. Yeah. That's true. That it is a really pertinent sort of statement of being in this current reality. I think that's true. Yeah. It's soothing in a cell. I guess I'm trying to, it seems like almost meditative. Like it's something you could,
which is funny, you know.
Yeah.
Meditation is funny.
Yeah. Meditation is funny. Like just the practice of meditation?
No, I don't know. I mean, I think it's kind of funny. Most things I love, I find very funny.
Do you practice meditation of some kind?
I do not.
Yeah.
No. I have other practices, but and they may or may not be somewhere in the forms of meditation, but strictly speaking, I do not practice meditation.
Sure. Yeah, I've struggled with it too. It seems like something that I should do. I have different methods of dealing with the stuff that I think people are trying to deal with meditation as well. And some people say going for a walk, which is something I try to do when it's not, it's currently, as I'm speaking to you, like minus 30 degrees Celsius here in.
Are you serious?
Yeah, yeah. It's funny. We're doing a Zoom family chat, and my sister and her family are in Nova Scotia, and it was plus one while it was minus 30 here yesterday. So the weather is still, you got all the seasons where you are, right? It gets cold, it gets warm.
Yeah, absolutely. It's on the cusp of the south, so.
Right.
Right now, it's probably hovering around, I don't know, 10, 11 degrees.
Right. Okay. So, yeah. But
it was colder than that 2 weeks ago.
Well, the point I'm trying to raise is, like, ideally, I would go for, if I was feeling like I needed some space or time to think or meditate, if you will, I'd go for a walk. And I found out, or I heard tell recently, that that's what walking is. If you go for a walk for that purpose, like just to get some fresh air and perspective, you're meditating. And I was like, oh. Mm-hmm. Didn't know that. I mean, I'm sure someone would see you performing your music and think, oh, he's in some sort of meditative state. Would you reject such a notion?
People can think whatever whatever. I wouldn't argue with anyone.
But from your
saying anything that whatever they see, how you know, I don't necessarily know better than they do.
Yeah.
It often does not very much feel like a meditative state. I mean, I'm out in public. I have a lot of gear around me. I'm thinking about what that has to do, and
yeah.
But sometimes it can be, for sure.
You're definitely. I'm not. You're in a heightened state, yeah. Right? There's tension and heightened. As a performer, as I recall, you either don't think about it at all and just do it, or you do enter a kind of zone of, okay, I'm performing now.
The zone, yeah.
So are you
the zone is always welcome.
Yeah.
One, I think I always welcome to be in the zone, but the zone is very open as to what that could be.
Right.
I've been in a lot of differing kinds of states when playing music, either alone or with others or in public or not in public.
Mm-hmm.
And, they all can be okay.
Right.
They all can give something. I mean, the performer can be feeling something that is not felt in the audience because I don't think a musician is always tapping into some kind of primordial state. I mean, we have practices. I've been thinking about music for over 40 years. And when I get up on stage, I have those 40 years of thinking. Mm-hmm. Where if I'm in a bad mood or I have a cold or I'm not feeling very good or I'm terrified of the state of the room I'm going to be sleeping in that night, I have a musical practice I can rely on to make music happen. I don't have to be in in a great mood to make music that I like.
Hmm.
And often that can be the case. And then maybe you feel better after. It'll change your way of feeling.
Yeah. Well, speaking of making music and feelings, if one were to simply read the press materials that accompany this record, I think it would be okay for them to assume that when they hit play, they might be hearing something more beat-oriented. There's a lot of language in the bio about how you used beats and drum machines, in fact, and were inspired by the likes of Gangstar and EPMD to create this record, Say Laura, but then as I listen to the record, I'm not sure those influences are as evident. Can you explain this how this all came to be and what this press release is all about?
Sure. I think I can do that. I mean, quite frankly, in the last few years, I have been listening to a lot of the hip-hop I was first introduced to. My lover, Mariette, I would say perhaps got into hip hop kind of post Wu-Tang.
Post Wu-Tang. Interesting.
So, and me being a little bit older and having gotten into it in the 80s and 90s, started kind of giving these like weekends of like the history of hip hop, you know, as told by somebody who is by no means an expert, but mm-hmm. I would go back, you know, Grandmaster Flash and all that stuff. And then when I would hit the late 80s, early 90s, I realized how much stuff I really love, and Gangstar probably, Step in the Arena especially, just being one of the most beautiful records I've ever heard. And I started putting it in my headphones and imagining slower beats that would make sense with that music, and I would tap them out on my drum machine while listening to that era of hip-hop. Not only that year of hip-hop, some of the beats come while listening to other things, but that was one of the things that was kind of a bit of an epiphany, where I would write beats that didn't even have songs yet, and I would create a catalog of beats.
Interesting.
Some of them would be 80-bar long beats, wouldn't repeat for 80 bars.
Huh.
And I would do that while listening to music I loved. You know, another way of kind of just sharing the joy of listening and having that be a part of music making. And so that's where that comes from. Apart from that, there isn't a whole hell of a lot of Gangstar on my record, no.
So if you can, by your reckoning, offer some perspective on that era that you're describing, late 80s, early 90s, in my reckoning of things, people like DJ Premier, you mentioned Wu-Tang, so I'll throw RZA into the mix. Eventually, Kanye West and his ilk were grabbing and sampling a lot of jazz, soul, certain kind of beats. Like, I think it sort of started out, particularly probably with the rise of both Public Enemy and Beastie Boys, there was a little more rock beat sampling.
And then it
sort of started to evolve where, I mean, particularly with Native Tongues and De La Soul and Tribe Called Quest, where the jazz records were more... It wasn't just the beats, it was the rhythm section, in fact. You would get the bass and the actual beats were from jazz records, if you will. And then it has evolved to wherever it's at the moment in terms of it being kind of open season, I think, and some of those same samples are being so genetically modified that you can't really find the source. You can't figure out the source as much. Anyway, I'm a totally leading question. To your reckoning, how would you characterize the beats that you that inspired you to actually create your own? Do you see, in terms of their origin, if you will, like do you see any commonality?
Well, I don't know. I don't really know how I can answer that question other than, as I said, I made those beats while listening to other music, and then the tempos would have to be adjusted when they started to be attached to a song.
I see. Okay.
Often they had to be adjusted quite a lot slower.
So you weren't thinking of obviously. The fact that it might be a jazz record that was grabbed, or a soul record or a rock record. You were simply reacting to whatever had been modified and then trying to emulate that. So it's like a
especially that era, especially the cusp of from the 80s into the 90s, which is the cusp of hip hop that I'm kind of talking about there. One of the things that I love about that music is that there wasn't that many choruses.
Yeah.
They rhymed nonstop.
Yeah.
Guru, just the amount of sentences that he would write for each song.
Yeah.
This torrent of joy. And I love that, you know. I love Sizzla for that too.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously Chuck D is killer in that way.
Yeah.
Where just the amount of words, I love that very much. Well, so
yeah,
that's a big part of what I love about that music. The fact that it's funky as hell. Sure, that I don't know if I can separate those two things.
Well, the combo of Guru and Primo, like, that is a ridiculous configuration. Like, that's magical, and I think underrated, frankly. Mm. Like, we lost Guru, and that's sad. And Premier is still out there doing beats, but it is remarkable how distinctive both are. Both, to have two entities. I mean, I guess Eric B and Rakim might be. It's similar. Just like the combination of two very gifted artists doing that kind of stuff, but Premier's beats are particularly unique, right? I mean, I know you've been kind of obsessed with it, but as you taught your hip hop course to your lady friend, obviously Gangstar stuck out, but can you home in on his production? Like, what do you have any?
No. I'm an idiot when I listen to Jeej.
Okay.
Historically, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about what I'm listening to. And I don't mean that to be evasive to the question. Quite truthfully, I usually don't have any fucking idea what's going on.
I see.
With what I'm listening to. And then, sure, I can reflect upon it. But the that isn't necessary. And I could say what with Gangstar and EPMD and that whole era, it's the buoyancy.
Yeah.
Which is a generality. I can't really talk about how they made those sounds. Whether what kind of, I don't know what's that they use to, I have no idea how you make that music.
Right.
No clue. And I'm never going to make it. So I don't have to know. I'm one of the lucky ones that doesn't have to know. I just get to hear it and enjoy it and get blown away by it. But there is a certain buoyancy, and that buoyancy definitely comes from the jazz lifting, which you hear on on that Tribe Called Quest record with the live bass player, the Low End Theory.
Yeah.
And all the De La Soul, all that music, you know, when you compare it to like maybe Eric B and Rakim, which has this kind of incredible minimalism to it. I mean, these are not swinging beats.
No.
When you compare them to something like Gangstar or EPMD or all the other ones I'm talking about, there's a kind of buoyancy and a kind of live swinging. They swing like crazy.
Yeah.
And I love that because, you know, what can I say? I love jazz music too.
Well, I mean, and I appreciate that people like Eric Sermon and I appreciate that they did too and realized mm-hmm. it was really sort of a it's roots for them, I think, in a way mm-hmm. that whether their parents listened to it, I know in interviews, like if you look at what RZA would sample on Wu-Tang, like clearly, that's like my favorite thing is going to find like the source of a sample. Mm-hmm. And then you okay. check out the context and you realize there's a good chance that RZA was 11 years old when he heard this record for the first time, or mm-hmm. Eric Sermon as well. Anyway, it's just interesting because I know, you know, you are, I think, also a deep jazz fan. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Without any doubt.
Yeah. So this is an interesting, you doing what you're doing on this record, which we haven't even got to the real point of the matter is you wrote to beats, but then as far as I can tell, you removed the beats. Is that a fair?
Okay. Yeah. I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's a bit technically complicated, but basically those beats are not heard as they are. The drum machine, no one hears, but they work, they are plugged into a source because I am able to make synthesized chords out of my guitar while I'm playing live. And those beats would trigger the opening of that synthesized harmonic material to create a beat-driven harmonic material, which are the beats that you do hear. So it's a combination of something pre-recorded opening something that is very live.
Right.
So that it's not, there's no loops. We're not hearing anything pre-recorded other than a rhythm, but not the actual material, the actual harmonic material of that rhythm.
Is there a version of this record that contain, like not a version of this record, like is there, well, yeah, sure. The two questions, I guess. Did Ryan, when he was conceiving of his parts for the songs he appears on, did he hear the beats or did he just hear your...
He just heard what I gave him, which right. is what you've heard.
So is there any chance we might someday, and this is not to suggest they're lacking, but just as a curiosity, is there any chance we might hear the versions of these pieces that did contain your slowed down interpolation of hip hop beats? That's an amazing sentence. That's an amazing question.
Different.
That's a good question. I'm proud of that question. It's a.
It doesn't sound that different though, Vish. It's just instead of hearing, like, let's see, on the title track, say Laura.
Yeah.
I think it goes, bow 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 bow. Bow, bow, bow. And if you heard what came out of what's actually triggering that, all you'd hear is. You hear how there's not really that much of a difference. You'd just be hearing the drum machine rather than what the drum machine is opening. This is very complicated. I don't expect.
Listen to me. I'm a drummer. So whenever I hear that the drum beats were included and then taken away, my whole okay. brethren gets a little sensitive. What are you doing?
No, I hear you. What I can answer that by, I am very much considering the next record being a Toronto band. So you would definitely be hearing beats because there would be two drummers on that playing on that record.
Is there any example that you can think of an artist doing this where they played? I'm sure there are many versions of this sort of thing where instruments were employed and then removed. But I'm having trouble thinking of an example of someone using certain instrumentation, in this case, drums. Let's just call them drums. Mm-hmm. As a compositional mm-hmm. instigator and then yeah. building around them, but then removing what was ostensibly the initializing entity. I just can't. Is there any example of this that you can think
Absolutely.
of?
Absolutely. There are so many different ways and so many fun things to talk about with that question, Vish. you've opened up a can of worms. Let's talk about, to be a little bit more gracious before I start going in on something a little bit more off the beaten path, I think in every recording of most major pop, R&B, rock records, there's a whole bunch of stuff that gets erased. Hmm. One can think of Prince erasing the bass from Kiss.
Right.
Which was just a stellar move. That lightened up the, I mean, I don't know, it probably sounds incredible anyways with the bass.
Yeah.
But so there's that to just take, I mean, especially an R&B track that is bound to be a hit, to remove bass from it is pretty interesting move. Mm. So there's, I think that the other way, instead, not necessarily of always removing them, but of composing palimpsestically. So that means, you know, having something, recording over it, to the point where you no longer hear the track that you started with. I think this is something that, especially with home recording, is probably something that is now in the mainstream as a compositional form. Mm. I think that's a pretty good answer. I was going to go into a piece of music from the 70s or 80s that I love very much that uses that as a kind of conceptual starting point. Yeah. But I think that that's pretty good.
No, it is good. You cited Prince and some other, alluded to other examples. Is this something you've done before where you've started with?
Absolutely.
You do it?
Yeah, okay. I mean, there's a piece of music. It's called 1-2-1-2-3-4 by Gavin Bryars. Yeah. Please don't listen to the version where they play Beatles songs. But basically the idea is, and you have people like Derek Bailey, Gavin Bryars, Brian Eno in this group, composed by Gavin Bryars, and everyone has headphones on, and they're all listening to a mixtape of basically jazz standards, whether sung by Mel Torme or I don't know. I haven't had access to the original tape. I've played this piece arranged by Martin Arnold, but I have not... I don't have much knowledge about the original other than it's amazing. Mm. And so they're all listening to cassettes. And so Gavin Bryars starts off by saying 1-2-1-2-3-4. And at that moment, everybody in the band presses play on their cassettes. I think everyone starts off with the same couple songs. And then at that point, each tape starts to diverge from each other. And also you have the fact that they're dealing with a mechanical object of a tape recorder. So it's already going to be slightly out of sync. Mm-hmm. All the musicians are told to play their instrument. So if there's a jazz guitar, like, I don't know, somebody playing jazz guitar on a Mel Torme tune, Derek Bailey has to play what that guitar player is playing, or at least try. Some people more or less did their homework. Some people didn't. And it's a beautifully psychedelic piece of music where basically it's exactly what you are talking about. Hmm. We are hearing everything but the source.
And to come full circle to our conversation, that's very funny. That's a funny...
It's hilarious and it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly beautiful recording. Dreamy and shares so much with... the original source material. That's what's so crazy about it, is how beautiful it is. And in fact, I record guitar solos without listening to the original track all the time.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So you've hit upon something that's very dear to me, because what I want to hear is something that I feel like, okay, I know generally what mode I have to play in so that it's not completely out of tune, but I kind of want to hear what two things that weren't played at the same time or with reference to each other, what they sound like. And I think that's what we're talking about here.
I think the analogy that might work in this case, and tell me if it's wrong, but it would be like you build a shelf with a hammer and some nails, but then when the shelf is done, you put the hammer away, and when someone comes to observe your work, the hammer is implied, but it's not there.
Huh. I like this.
The tool, of course, had to be a part of the structure, but we don't really engage with the tool after. So in a sense, in your practice, in this record in particular, the beats were a tool to get you somewhere, and then... But you don't say to someone, Not only do I want to show you the shelf I built, look at the hammer. Here's the hammer I used. The person would be like, okay, that's nuts. Like, I don't care about that. Of course, I assume you had a hammer. So it's like a weird, it's like a weird, it's almost process oriented. I don't know. It's like you're putting the tools away and just presenting the record as the finished shelf. Does that make any sense? I think I'm obsessed with this analogy because eventually I'm going to get your record in its physical form and I'm going to put it on the shelf beside me. That's what I'm thinking.
Well, there's the link.
There's
okay.
the link. Yeah.
Well, I think what you've hit upon here, Vish, is a sweet little corner of the world of art making, which is the compulsiveness for one to perhaps desire to understand how something is made.
Yes.
And although I understand that, it has nothing to do with how I listen to music. I don't know how to make a shelf. I have an idea how to make a very bad shelf, but if I saw a well-made shelf, I would not know how it's made, sure. and I could enjoy that shelf. I think that because of how, for many reasons, big and small, funny and not, we don't always allow that same principle to be there when we're looking at art or reading literature or listening to music. This idea of not understanding, which isn't just a lack, it opens up a space for something else to happen, something incredibly beautiful to happen, where, you know, I've said this a million times in interviews, that there's a lot of time during the day where we have to use our understanding, our comprehension, what they call common sense. For me, art and a lot of other things as well are a space where I do not need that. And in that way, it is a way out of being chained to this idea of everything having to be within the bars of comprehension.
I appreciate that totally. And the only other thing I'll say about this, though, and not to contradict what you're saying, is the thing is, this record, if I had gotten this record and there was no biographical information, I would not ask you this line of questioning. Where are the beats? They said there's going to be beats.
Yeah.
So the thing is, the intention with this press material that I'm, and you know, as I say, 90% of the people, or I didn't say this, but I'll say it now, 90% of the people listening to us having this conversation may never encounter this press material in its original form. You might talk about it in other interviews. Other media outlets might pick up on this as just an intro. It's totally interesting. Like, that's why I'm asking about it. It's totally interesting that you would do it.
Well, but, I mean, that's a bit of the collaboration I have with Constellation, the record label I'm on, and Ian Ilavsky, with whom I work on these things for.
Yeah.
I write a whack of stuff that's very stream of consciousness, and I write it to him very privately, or more or less, and I give it to him. And I'm like, if you find any of this interesting, you know, that's where Ian takes over. And I don't really question anything I've given him, for the most part.
Yeah.
It's usually two or three pages of ramblings and and some of it not necessarily even true necessarily. But they're not lies either. They're just, you know, one must be weary of artists talking about their own work, especially right after.
Well, you know? And I appreciate all of those things. And I appreciate that you sent him what you sent. You sent Ian what you sent him. And he did what he wanted to do with it. He obviously picked up on the same thing I'm picking up on, which is that's fascinating. The way you made this record is fascinating. However, what I was going to say is it points out the absence of something. So what I'm saying is, in a sense, you didn't have to convey this ghost in the machine of your songs. Like, you didn't have to, I think I used that expression wrong, but never mind. I think you didn't have to really, none of you had to say this. Like, you're pointing out something that none of us would have thought of as a thing that makes us think of that thing. So I already said, where's the, I, now that you've said it's not here, I want to hear it, like a baby, like a child. I want the thing that isn't here that you told me was, that could have been here, just out of some gluttony or selfishness. So it's just, you could have just put it out and not mentioned this, and no one would have been the wiser. So there's a little bit of intention there in this.
To be fair to Ian, I think he was trying to get at something that's very hard because it's so technical. It involves words like noise gate and key inputs. I mean, these are not digital. This is not Max SP or whatever the hell that is. this is just a rudimentary synthesizer pedal using technology from the 50s. So it's not highfalutin in any way.
Yeah.
And I think Ian has tried in one way or another to talk about process. And that's always tricky, but I trust him.
Yeah.
And I think he did a pretty good job, but I think what's very important to talk directly to your concern, Rish, is that you're not missing anything.
No. And I don't feel I am. The record's gorgeous and beautiful. It's just interesting that we've spent a good 45 minutes talking about nothing. Like talking about something that isn't even there, but it was there. So that's on me. But it's also fascinating that this was where I feel like you get press materials like this, and if you read them, I listen to records as much as I can to make my own opinions, and then I might read something like this after just to see where the two meet, my feeling and what was conveyed by the artist or their people. Mm-hmm. So it's just all I'm getting at, and it's not a criticism. It's just fascinating that this conversation was precipitated on this biographical information about a record talking about something that isn't even on the record. Like, I'm not saying it's...
But it is, Rish.
But it is on...
I think I get very much what you're talking about, and I don't hear it as being we're talking about lack or that you want to hear something more.
Yes.
That's not... I know exactly what you mean. What I'm telling you in this precise instance, you're missing... If I added the beat into it, all it would do was create a mild more amount of attack.
Right, sure.
From the beat you're already hearing.
Yeah.
That's it.
Okay.
If you ever come by the house, I'll show you how it goes.
I'd like to see how this happens the next time I'm in France, for sure.
It's very dumb.
Yeah.
You'll be very disappointed.
Say Laura is an interesting turn of phrase. It's the title track of a piece, and titles... for better or for worse, can capture something about the whole of a work. Why did that expression and that, I guess that song, why did you choose to focus our attention on that? Say Laura.
This is going to go into some very, very imagining of reality here, because again, all of my lyrics are written in collaboration with Ryan Driver.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you've touched upon one that Ryan came up with. Now, whether I actually... We have a process where he listens to how I'm singing and he kind of makes up words that he thinks make sense to what he thinks I'm saying. That's what. So I mumble some stuff and I imagine that I must have had something that sounded a lot like Laura, because in fact the song is very much a very direct homage to the song Laura from the is it a film? I think it's a film, Laura. It's a song that has been sung by many. It's been sung by Frank Sinatra. It's been sung by, hell, even Robert Wyatt gave it a good go.
Oh.
But the versions that really killed me, there's especially one sung by Gene Lee. Also, Charlie Parker with Charlie Parker and Strings, even though there's no singing on that one, but it's beautiful.
Oh, they did an interpretation of the song. I see. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, he did a beautiful orchestral interpretation of the song.
Okay.
And sometimes I am listening to a song and I think, I wish I wrote that song.
Mm.
So then I say to myself, well, why don't you then, Eric, write it?
Mm.
And so I start with the beginning cadence, which starts not unlike mine, and I go from there.
I see.
So I use, again, not very different from how I was listening to EPMD beats. I use other music to get me going, because standing there with nothing is not what I do very often. It does happen, but often I find kind of weird little ways to get me going. And that song has been one that I've loved for a very, very long time. And there's, and sometimes when you try, when you start copying it with the intent of, you know, wanting to erase any attempt at copying, letting it go where it's going to go, you learn something about why that song works.
Yeah.
And that's interesting to me.
Yeah.
For somebody who has had a very autodidactic relationship with studying music, I'm continually learning, and writing for me is a way of learning not only how things I do work, but how other things work. So whether it be starting with a harmonic improvisation by Thelonious Monk, or a set of chords played by Sun Ra, or Gene Lee cadencing Sailora so insanely beautifully that your heart melts.
Yeah.
I use these things to get going, to start something. And weirdly, Ryan came back with the lyrics that actually have the name in it.
I see.
Which is kind of mind-blowing. But working with Ryan, you see, these kinds of things can happen.
Well, I appreciate your dedication to the truth as well, because these are all things you, like I said, and I'm not questioning, I feel like I sound like someone who's questioning the existence of this particular biographical and press release oriented information. Like, why are you telling me everything? But I feel like you're being honest about it. These are the, all the names you just mentioned are mentioned in this PR. Mm-hmm. The beats are mentioned in this PR. They're not unimportant. They are significant to the shape of this record. So sometimes I think we forget that when a label or an artist releases such information, it's a little diary entry for themselves. Mm-hmm. As much as
it's also a way of distinguishing, you know how press works there, Vish. I don't know. You've been around. You know, you got to find an angle.
Yeah.
You got to get an angle.
Yeah.
And, you know, my records sound really like each other. So coming up with a new angle isn't child's play. So, you know, just I think Ian's always looking for an angle.
Yeah.
And he's doing it with love in his heart.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he found it. And I don't think you could talk about exactly how this record was made. And I don't think it really changes how one hears it, really.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's an absolutely gorgeous record. And it's another one from you. You're someone I love very much, Eric, as an artist and as a person. So I appreciate, I hope this didn't come across as some sort of interrogation, inquisition even.
I think you know it didn't, Vish.
Okay, good. So you alluded to the fact that you're already contemplating a Toronto band record at some point, but do you actually have any firm future plans, or is it possible to cite even tour dates given the calamitous and ever-changing circumstances we're in? Like, do you have any plans that you can share beyond the release of Sailor?
Yeah, I do have some concerts coming up in France and the UK in the end of February. Whether they happen or not, we will have to see.
Yes.
And then after that, there will be, again, we will have to see quite a bit of touring, if it's possible.
Okay.
The idea is yes. And whether that includes North America or not, I imagine I have my eyes set on the fall for returning to the Ontario region at the very least. Ontario, Quebec region at the very least, yeah. That's what I...
You're saying I'll have to fly home if I want to see you, basically, at this...
I don't know.
Potentially.
I don't know. If somebody invites me to Edmonton, you know, I'm a pretty hospitable dude.
Okay, well, I'm inviting you now. I have to figure out the rest of the stuff, but consider this an invitation, and I'll figure out... I don't know anything. I don't know anyone, really, because as soon as we got here, everything locked down.
I
met a few people.
I know the feeling. I know. We came at the beginning of the first confinement here. And so it's a very interesting way to get to know a city.
Yeah, absolutely. So for people who want to learn more about Sailora and you, I know that they can go to cstrecords.com for all the comprehensive info about you and your releases. But are you on anything else? Do you use any of the internet?
I do use parts of the internet. I have a what they call a website.
Oh, yes.
Which is very obvious. It's my name at myname.com or whatever.
Just to be clear, ericchanot.com. You didn't buy the rights to myname.com.
I'm sure that one was taken pretty early in the internet's history.
Yeah, probably.
And I did not have access to that. No. Okay. So it's ericchanot.com, whatever. And, well, we'll see. You know, I'm flirting with doing some other things.
Are you flirting with... everyone seems to be flirting with Instagram. Instagram is the one, or Twitter, I feel like,
Twitter
is the one
Twitter I won't do. Well, I can't say that. The world is an elusive place. I don't know what I'll be doing. But Instagram's probably... I can foresee that happening. Yeah.
Some of our mutual friends use Instagram, and I'm surprised at how much they use Instagram, given what I think I know of them, but they seem to enjoy it. So I hope that's the case for you as well, and hopefully you can still get either at Eric Chanot on Instagram or perhaps at my name at Instagram. We'll figure it out. We'll figure it out and keep an eye on your website and everything else. Eric, this was fun for me, but before we go, is it possible for you to pick a song from Say Laura? For us
I think that we should listen to Say Laura, and then people should go and find the song Laura, sung by Jean Lee, and see what they think about that.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. Makes sense to me for sure. Okay. This is, by the way, I don't know if this is going to appear on the record as such, but there are two versions of Say Laura in my, the thing I got. One says Say Laura. The other says Say Laura Radio Edit. And I don't know.
Isn't that amazing?
Is that going to be on your record? Or will there be two versions?
No.
No. Okay.
I think maybe on the Bandcamp page there will always be access to that. I mean, basically it's the song minus all the guitar solos.
You know, I see. Okay. Well, I'm going to play the real one. I don't want to play
whatever you want, Vish.
Let's play it. This is the title track from the beautiful new record Say Laura, which is available everywhere February 18th in the year 2022 via Constellation Records. Go get it. Go order it. Whatever you have to do. Eric, thank you so much, as always, for talking to me at all and for being on my show. I wish you the best of luck with everything in the future, and I hope we speak again soon.
The pleasure was mine, Vish. Thank you very much.
Lost in our minds. Look at that one whole moon, two palm trees. I've been put in moonlight. Say more. Look at that. What a night. Burn love away. So long at last. So long. It's easy when we're going out of mind, two worlds are one line. If you wanted love, I wanted to remain in love with us. And if you're
I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Oh, what a lovely song. What a lovely treat to have Eric Chenow back on this show. Thank you, Eric, for being on this, the 662nd episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my somewhat dormant, it's quite dormant. I have a monthly newsletter, but I'm busy. And I don't know what I want to say in it sometimes because I say so much stuff all the time. Still, I'll get it going. This is the year. It's 2022 as I'm talking to you, or as you're listening to this. And as I'm talking to you, I'm not from some other dimension. Anyway, I'll get that going again. So anyway, what was I saying? Yeah, if you want to find old episodes, learn about me, sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. And also like Creative Control on Facebook there. Follow the show on Twitter at Vish Creative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter or on Instagram at Vish Khanna. Also visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to consider making a flexible monthly donation to sustain this particular podcast. $6 or more grants you access to exclusive content that's not available for free, I guess is the way to put it. And sometimes that includes old archive interviews I've done. Sometimes that includes some bonus material I've gathered from a current interview. It's all over the place, really, and other stuff too. Anyway, if you're interested in any of those things or receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, just message me on Patreon and I will get you one while supplies last. And again, that address, patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks again to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. You can learn more about them by clicking on the links, ideally what you're looking at. When you look at this podcast, there's some hyperlinked text there. Just click on those links and you can learn more about those businesses. Also want to thank my friend Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music of his on the show. You can learn more about Jim, who I'm texting with right now, actually, about something else. Anyway, you can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Eric Chenow. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll check out Eric's beautiful new album, Say Laura, which is available at cstrecords.com via Constellation Records, as you already have heard. It's wonderful, and I thank you for checking out this episode and for telling your friends about this show and maybe subscribing to it or following it. However you do those things, spreading the word, all that stuff helps. So thank you. I will talk to you very soon. Take care, and bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.